What's up, everyone? Welcome to today's episode of Torkum Talk. I am so excited about today's guest, Jamie Denick. She is the founder and CEO of Hum Kombucha, the kombucha company of the US, the brand. She built it from scratch, out of bathtub, so to speak, 10 years ago, being the kombucha lady that brought it to you like the milkman, to now being like a partner with the NFL. So, you know, a little bit higher up there. How'd she do it? That's what we got into. How can she get better? That's what we got into. What's her vulnerabilities? Got into that. Hope you guys enjoy this wide range of conversation between me and Jamie Denick. So for those that don't know, you're CEO of Hum, and it's a leader in the kombucha market. For those that don't know, just really quickly, like, what's kombucha, stuff like that. What is it? What are the health benefits of it? Why did you decide to get involved in kombucha?
So kombucha is basically a probiotic tea, and it really, really just helps you feel better. So you can go online and you can hear, you can read all these things. It's going to cure cancer. It's going to do all this crazy stuff. I don't know if it does any of that. But what I do know is it balances your system. And in America, we eat the way we eat. Generally in America, we have an acidic diet, and kombucha is a pH balancer. So it actually just balances out your system. So you eat the way you eat, drink kombucha, and it becomes a very becomes an addictive cycle. This is part of the phenomenon of kombucha, is because your body wants to be in balance, and we eat the way we eat. And so you continuously want to be in balance, and so you start to crave it. And so this is a good thing, because it's probiotics and B vitamins, and you know, having a body in balance makes many things in your life better.
Great. What? Tell me about the early days. So I don't, the last time we met was like 3 years ago. I've known of you, you were in passing here and there. But I knew Kombucha Mama, which is what Hum used to be. And I knew that you guys were, at the time that you were on my radar of just a business in Bend that was doing something, was a pretty small facility. I think you're off of Second, where you still are today, but it was definitely smaller than the location that you have today. But there had to have been a time even before that.
Oh, yeah, in Michelle's kitchen where it started.
Yeah, tell me about that.
That it started in her kitchen?
Yeah, pretty much. So how did you guys decide that we're going to start making kombucha and we're going to start selling it?
Yeah. So it was 2008, and the Bend was a bit of a mess. It was the time when the recession had happened, and both of us had just moved to Bend. I had moved from Philadelphia. She had moved from the Midwest. Mm-hmm. We didn't know anybody in town. We met in a tennis court. We became fast friends. And my job ended when the stock market crashed. I had a business for 15 years, and I didn't love it, so I didn't want to rebuild it. So I decided I was going to do something new. And then I met Michelle, and we'd sit at the kitchen table, and we'd laugh and laugh. And neither of us had jobs. We didn't actually know anybody in town. But we were stoked all the time.
Sure.
And we thought it was the kombucha that was making us feel so good. So we decided to get in the Prius and start the 2008 version of the Milkman. And we delivered gallon glass jars of kombucha to people for $20. So basically leave it on their doorstep. We'd collect $20. We'd put a fresh jar of kombucha. And we didn't know anybody in town either. So we basically sent an email out to like 15 people, some teachers and some neighbors, and said, hey, if you want to feel better for $20, we've got the answer. And within a couple weeks, we were on a wait list. And that lasted for the next 4 years.
So how did you go about, were you getting it, making sure everything was FDA approved when you were handing out and stuff like that? Like, you know, all the rigmarole and the kitchen licenses and all that stuff?
Well, yes and no. So when we first started delivering it, no.
Okay.
And then we realized that we needed to make this happen. So we called the Department of Agriculture, who monitors beverages. We said, hey, we have this beverage. Will you come over and make Michelle's kitchen a kitchen that we can actually produce product out of? Because we wanted to sell to Newport Market. This is why it happened. And Newport Market said, you have to have this approved. We're like, oh, who should we call? And then we figured out what to do. So he came over and he said, okay, I don't know what to do with you guys. Most people are trying to get bacteria out of their facilities. You're trying
You're
to grow
trying
bacteria.
To get it in. Yeah.
And so it was hilarious. Mm-hmm. And we kind of held hands with the Department of Agriculture all these years, because we were one of the first, certainly the first in Central Oregon, and them having to understand how to make sure that it's safe when you're trying to grow it versus taking it out. So yeah, we were we were validated early on, but not until a retailer said, you have to get validated. And we're like, what?
Didn't you find that a bit like powerful? What I see though is like all these people that are trying to get like validated before they even know if people want what they have.
Oh, people wanted it. We were out of stock.
Right. But you knew that because you were going out and you were doing it.
Yeah.
You're like, let's just go see. Hey, we'll send out the emails to 15 people and then hopefully it grows from there. Hey, we have an answer for you, $20. And you had enough to make it a side hustle, or it sounds like your primary hustle at the time.
It was my very low paid primary hustle. I was about 3 cents an hour for the first couple of years.
So then you jump through the hoops and you get approved. And your first retailer was Newport?
No, our first retailer was Sparrow Bakery.
Okay.
Followed by Pizza Mondo, Jackson's, Perea, Mother's. Mm-hmm. Newport was a little bit later because Newport you had to like have labeling and proper things, and the rest of them you didn't.
And when did you start having like the up and to the right moment?
Literally from when we started. I mean, it was like a rocket ship.
You couldn't keep up with
them. We couldn't keep up. And kombucha is, you know, it's one makes two makes four makes eight as far as the mother splits.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a sourdough starter and you can keep splitting it, but it takes a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time we moved to our first facility, which was 6 months after we started, we had 256 gallon glass jars going in one of Michelle's closets. And that's when we moved. So we were delivering to 256 people, and we had a closet where you just had like the Home Depot racking, and it was this tiny little closet, but uh-huh.
It was just going to the ceiling.
It was just going to the ceiling. Yeah. We had notes on all of them about when it was due and all that good stuff.
Would you do that process again, how you guys went through it? Or if you were to look back at when you first got started, like, oh, we probably should have gotten approved here. We should have gone to this retailer.
Okay, I think part of the problem of starting a business is you try and get all your ducks in a row before mm-hmm. you start it, and there's so many hurdles to getting your ducks in a row. Sometimes it kind of inhibits us from actually getting started.
Yeah.
So I think there's something really very genuine and sweet about doing it, and while you're doing it, figuring it out, as mm-hmm. long as you're not hurting anybody, right?
Sure.
But I think that way you're getting immediate feedback. You're also seeing what's working and what's not working real time as you're figuring it out.
You're also getting motivated, right? Like mm-hmm. people want what we're trying to do, as opposed to I'm trying to get everything together. I'm not really that sure. And 3 months go by, 6 months go by, a year goes by. I put so much time and energy and money. God, I hope this works. And you guys know, like, hey, we had the... we had people from day one wanting to do the Kombucha Mama milkmaid service, and then milkman, milk person. What's politically correct?
I don't know.
I don't know either. And then you have the orders in Sparrow and Jackson, and so I'm guessing those were selling pretty quickly, and you're just trying to restock those into glass bottles.
So we didn't have glass bottles at the time. Everything was on draft.
Okay.
So we did everything. So we didn't have to package or do anything like that. Everything was on. We just sold kegs. Actually, at the time, we sold gallon glass jars to everybody. We didn't sell kegs at the time.
Okay.
So we went from gallon glass jars to kegs to bottles, and mostly because of convenience and ease.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is this idea of like, it's everybody has a great idea. It's there's a million great ideas, and then you have to be able to execute. So you have to be able to get stuff done, but also somebody has to buy your product. Like, so there is a very those three things absolutely have to happen in order to find any kind of success. And I think if you stay in the planning stages for too long, sometimes you plan yourself out of a business.
I would absolutely agree.
Yeah.
So you guys were Kombucha Mama, and then something also on this really quick on what you're just saying, I was just thinking about with your name is the planning stage, right? There's so many entrepreneurs that I've talked to me about, I'm not sure what to name it. And they spend all this time on a name, and they all get all caught up. And so where I'm going with this is that you guys had Kombucha Mama. I love that name. I thought that name was great. And then through grapevine of Ben, oh, they're doing a rebrand. And then you guys came out with Hum. And I honestly thought, well, that's crap compared to Kombucha Mama. I was very wrong.
Mm, right? A lot of people.
Right. And so, and then you guys just really took off. But my question is, what was it like for you going through that rebrand? How was it difficult? Was it easy? Did you have second thoughts on it? Like, just walk us through that rebrand process.
Okay, so we went to a advertising place called TBD in town, and we said, hey, we're in like beer bottles, we're in 24 packs, they leak, we have all sorts of issues, can you help? And mm-hmm. they said, sure. And they said, would you consider changing your name? We said, that's the dumbest idea we ever heard. We're Kombucha Mama. Mm-hmm. And 6 months later, we changed our name. And I think that part of that has to do with these guys are experts in what they do. And if you're going to partner with experts and people that are really good at what they do, you have to like, listen to what they say. And it really, it was 6 months. It was pretty brutal. Mm-hmm. And it's like your baby or a founder, right? And there was every reason to say why this wasn't a good idea. And there was a lot more reasons to say why this was a good idea. And most of it had to do with the reason I was talking to you about the why and the book, you know, the Simon Sinek book, is it's all about your why. Like if you're really, really clear about why you do what you do or why you're doing, then every time you stumble, you can go back and have clarity from the actual why versus because you're going to stumble along the way. You're going to second guess yourself. You're going to hit roadblocks. It's just the way it goes. And if you are really clear about why you're doing what you're doing, you can always go back to that and go, okay, it's okay that I'm having a roadblock. It's okay that I'm stumbling right now. So we got really clear on the why we would switch the name. And once we were clear on that, it was there was no stopping us. And as a matter of fact, one of our distributors, right before we switched, who is Bigfoot in town, the Pepsi distributor, we were upwards of $1 million brand at that point. And they said, this is a really bad idea. You have a cult-like following. People love your brand. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. And we were like, oh my gosh, you have no idea what's about to happen. Like, it's this is going to explode. So Kombucha Mom is a story about two women. It's a story about two moms in a kitchen.
Right.
Home is about a movement. It's about a group of people. It's about a energy. It's kind of how you feel. You hum when you're happy. You hum, mm-hmm. you would hear the brewery humming. And then the goal was accessibility, so that we had this product that was very accessible. Most of the other kombuchas were a little bit maybe harder to drink, and they all got sold at health food stores. Bar product was sold everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And Kombucha Mama was weird. We had a lotus flower on there. It seemed very inclusive. We were looking, it seemed very exclusive.
I know what you're saying. Yeah. You were
versus
in the society.
Versus hum is like, hum anybody can access.
Yeah,
anybody.
The bottle is just pictures of everything going on.
And the name, I mean, it's an American name.
Sure.
You hum when you're happy. Humming is just a part of, you know.
Were you guys one of the, I don't know, I think you were, but were you one of the first, at least in Central Oregon, to be like in gas stations as a kombucha?
We were the only ones. We were the first in the country to be in gas stations, as far as I know, if not the first, one of the first. Nobody was, all the other kombuchas were at health food stores. They were all fighting over the shelf space, but we asked the question of like, what if you didn't shop at a health food store? Would you be interested in something that tasted really good that was really good for you?
Okay, so let's dive into that really quick. That decision-making process. There's a lot of risk right there, right? Let's put something towards something that hasn't been done, but you guys went to do it. Let's be in gas stations and in front of Safeway and things of that nature. What made you say, okay, yeah, let's try it? Because that's like you have to commit reps, resources, and times to it. You have to commit marketing time to it. You have to commit buying shelf space that hopefully it works. If you do land the accounts, then you have to hope that people end up buying it. So what made you guys be like, yeah, no, this is totally going to work. We're going to do it. Because nobody's done it before. This is scary.
Well, I think there's a level of risk aversion that people have. I don't know that I have a barometer on risk. Like I just
I don't
see
think
an
I have
opportunity.
One either, but I'm just
this is an entrepreneur.
I saw it, I'm like, let's do it. Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
Well, and I think that I think passion, you have to be incredibly passionate about what you're doing because you have to be able to talk people into whatever it is you're excited about. And then you have to really believe it. And that goes back to the why. Every time you go back to the why and it no matter what you hit along the way, it's like we tested it and people were drinking it like Food for Less. Ethnic grocery store. 50, 60, 70 kegs a week. We would pull people. We had to bring people in that spoke Spanish and say, can you translate for me? Why are you buying this product? Spanish people would say, I don't know. I feel so good. I can't afford it, but I keep feeling really good and I keep buying it. And so we knew we were onto something. And then it was a matter of talking the retailers into doing something different and unique. And you'd find those retailers that like, that are really progressive and pioneering and want to be the first, and you capitalize on that. And you make it sound like it's so compelling and they can't lose and they're going to be the first and they're going to get all the recognition, and you kind of play to that and then you deliver. You execute at an exponential level. You do everything you're going to say you do on top of. You make it super easy to work with you, even if you don't know what you're doing. You be upfront, you're super transparent and authentic and be like, hey, I don't know what I'm doing. I need some help. If you help me, let's do this versus, you know, just shooting in the dark.
So that's the why that you've been explaining of the rebrand. Is that also the why of the company?
Accessibility.
Sure. I don't know. What is the why of the company?
It's to help people feel better, really, right. Because back to the kitchen table, the idea is if we could help a couple more people feel a little bit better. It's kind of like if you walk down the street and you ask somebody, do you want to feel better? Mm-hmm. Is anybody going to say no? probably not.
And they shouldn't.
So could you build a concept? Can you build a business on something as simple as helping people feel better? And that's not just a drink. That's also how you treat each other. Mm-hmm. That's how you have a culture within your company. That's how you treat your partners, treat your staff, treat your
vendors,
investors, everybody. Mm-hmm. But if you can take really good care and help somebody feel a little bit better, because honestly, taking good care of another person is human nature. We want to do it. I don't know that we always have the opportunity, but when you're in a situation where you have that opportunity, it's pretty cool.
That is until profit clouds that.
That is what?
That is until profit clouds that judgment.
Oh, yeah.
Which happens to so many people, right? Yeah, like, they're like, I want to do good, I want to do that, but I also want that check, and I want that yacht, and I want that plane.
Yeah. So we have a core value called, oh my gosh, I can't even think of the name of it at the moment. But it's what it reads is, it has to be financially and energetically sustainable. And actually, we say energetically first, because we believe that if the people are taken care of and they're taken care of really, really well and they feel really good, people will do great things. Mm-hmm. And so you'll get a financial benefit from taking really good care of people. And we play that over and over, and it's a tricky one. It's tricky because sometimes you gotta make a profit. There's things.
It is tricky. It's like when you get into when you're like, I want to do the right thing all the time, and you have that as the first notion in your mind, and then you come into this crossroads where like, what is the right thing here? Is do we save the company by letting a person go? Do we let this person go because they're not a good culture fit, but that is the right thing, but then they're going to be hurt? I view it that is the right thing, like if as far as like culture fits and things of that nature. But there is shades of gray, but I find that there's like this overwhelming human constitution that transcends all borders and political ones, country ones, that is just like, you know, deep down, what's the right thing to do? You know what's good. You know what's bad. And if you have to end up getting into a space in your mind where you're justifying something, then you're on the wrong track. You shouldn't have to justify what's good. So I have talked to a lot of people that have worked at your company, and I've heard a lot of amazing things on the culture, which was one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on the show. How'd you go about building that? So you start with you and Michelle.
Yeah. So by the way, the core value is healthy business, right? Creating something that's energetically and financially sustainable. That's one of our core values. So how do we build a culture? Well, we actually had Michelle's ex-husband, well, he was her husband at the time, who was a personal development, like owned a personal development company, been doing it for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And he really didn't have much to do with the business the first 4 years. He would come in and he would say, hey, you guys should read this book. Or, you know, he would say, hey, what are you working on? And make us sandwiches kind of thing. But he was super into personal development and super into culture. And so he really guided us. And, you know, we already knew what we wanted. Like, we, no gossip policy. Like, we were very clear about collaborative, taking really good care of each other. Like, the where we were going and how we were doing it was very clear. What we wanted was very clear. How to get there and how to get people bought into it was where he came in, and the first thing he did was core values. So once we were in business for like, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, we sat down for about a 6-month period. We'd get together every month with everybody that was in the company, which is like 6 of us or something. Mm-hmm. And we go, okay, like, what are the things that are really important? What is important to you? What is important to you as a company? And we came up with these 4 core values. And some of it had to do with, you know, you can't come in and be in a bad mood one day and make a call, and then the next day make a different call. Now we're women, right? We're moody, we're emotional. Like, we move a lot. Yeah, but men have other issues. I mean, generally speaking, women are much more emotional and much more. And so you have to be able to have guides so that it's not you that's making the call, but it's something for the company. Mm-hmm. And so we have these core values. And then, I mean, I could talk about culture all day, but these core values are like the pillars of our brand and what we're all about.
I like the way that you said that you came about creating them, which was similar to how we did it. There's a lot of companies that are like, these are our core values, and who comes up with it is the founders or whoever's in charge at the time, and they basically brainstorm for a little bit and they write down things that sound good, right? But what you did, and it's also what we did, was talk with the team and start what we did specifically is we were jotting up all the things that make us who we are, good or bad, and they all went on the board. And through eliminating and combining, we had these eight core values, and that was something that the team came together and found that these are the things that basically is what Mazama stands for. And sounds like you guys did something very similar. You had six people come together and you guys started talking together to come up with these core values, and you didn't dictate them.
Yeah. And very important to make sure that you're not trying to, not who you want to be, but actually who you are.
Right.
That was really important. It's like, oh yeah, we want to be that, but that's not who we are. Yeah.
It's very important. And then you'd have buy-in, right?
That's how you get buy-in. Just collaborate and everybody has a voice.
So how much time do you think you spend on culture?
A lot.
Percentage wise, what would you put it like in a given week, do you think?
So for me, so I have a business partner, Michelle. Mm-hmm. Her job is, she's our chief cultural angel. She works part-time. That's her job. Her job is internal staff, making sure that that is all. So 20 hours a week is spent on culture,
mm-hmm.
just Michelle. And then we have HR, and then we have me, and then we have a lot of people are pretty involved in the culture and making sure it's a living thing. So we talk about it and have meetings about it a lot. We have a steering committee. We have culture keepers that are in charge of, you know, doing all the events. And we have a lot of different things that we do with culture. So me, I don't know. I would say 5 hours at max, because my job is to take everything we're doing and share it with the world.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
So playing devil's advocate here, yeah, this culture kumbaya stuff, it sounds great, but I don't understand why it's important. We need to make money as a business. I'm trying to start this business to make more money. How do I make more money? Why does culture matter?
Well, that's what so many of us do. This is why we're having so many problems today, is we're so interested in the bottom line and we forget to take care of each other. I just think that people being bought into what you're doing and being bought into a common goal that isn't somebody's personal agenda, but actually what the business stands for,
mm-hmm.
makes people really want to work harder, and it makes them excited, and it makes them feel good about what they're doing, and it makes them go home and have good experiences about their career, which also then expands out to more people, right? Because their wives and husbands and kids and snowboarder friends and whoever they're associating with, it just spreads good vibes into the world. And, you know, again, we're about feeling good. We're about good vibes. That's it.
What are some times that you have like a smile on your face being like hearing about culture and like a little, I don't know if you want to call them like a success story within the company, just some things that you hear, people enjoying the work or stuff like that, like little things that just pop up and you're like, oh, that's because of culture. It's because of what Michelle and I are doing.
Well, first off, it's not Michelle and I anymore, because now we have like 70 some odd people. So now there's everybody's, and the culture is, Michelle and I don't have to be there anymore, and the culture lives and breathes. It's just so much more beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think my favorite thing about the culture is when people have a difficult conversation, they're really at odds with each other. And instead of the many dysfunctional ways that we handle things, gossip, or we talk to other people that can't help us, or we just fume about it, or we bury it, our culture is very much, let's talk about it and let's figure something out. And every time, both people feel a ton better. You have to be vulnerable. You have to kind of show yourself a little bit. And then you're just in a really loving environment that people take really good care of you. And it's massive personal growth, because our society, just generally speaking, we all handle conflict differently, but many of us aren't very healthy with conflict. So that's one of my favorite things about the culture, is having healthy conflict.
Yeah, we get into healthy conflict as well. As long as they're not screaming or yelling, it's just like, that's how you get to the core of the issue. Otherwise, people are just kind of holding back and they don't really buy in, and then there's no animosity.
Yeah.
So some of our leadership meetings get to be pretty fun. We get to be like a little bit of a movie going on in there.
Yeah.
So you mentioned being vulnerable. How do you think you are at showing your vulnerabilities?
Oh, I think I'm really good at it.
Oh, yeah? What are some of them?
How much time do you have?
You can say one, well, I'll say one. We just go back and forth.
I would say that I spend most of my days, probably 70% of my time, maybe 80-85% these days, doing things I'm not very good at. So I'm in a position where I'm not a natural manager. Mm-hmm. I don't like details, as you can imagine with my job. There's a lot of details. I don't like small talk.
I don't like details either.
Yeah.
I don't like small talk either.
Yeah.
I started a podcast. So, oh, well.
And now you're small talking. But I think that just being able to be authentic and real, There have been some really hard times. This has been really hard building this company. There's been months where I haven't slept. I haven't had any money. I've been on public health care.
Within the company.
Heck yeah. Building Kombucha Mama, we ate peanut butter and jelly for probably a year straight with my kids. We didn't have furniture for a couple of years. Like, we went totally broke building this brand. And
that's funny, because a lot of people just think that you're well off right from the beginning.
Oh, totally. And then you
have a pot of gold with a rainbow and a leprechaun and everything.
Yeah. And it's okay. It's okay to not know what you're doing. It's okay to raise your hand. I do it all the time. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, I just did it. I was just like, hey, it turns out I'm not good at sales management. We need to hire someone.
Yeah.
I thought that was hard for me, because my ego was coming up, and I was just like, no, you've built this thing up and sales have been strong, and all of a sudden it's just like, well, you're managing the marketing and you're managing the culture and some of those things are going right, but the sales management, you've been failing on all these people, or these people have been failing. It's their fault. Wait, what's the one constant variable? It's me.
Yeah.
So that was hard. That was 2 weeks ago.
But nice.
Yeah, but I was able to say it in a leadership meeting, and I think we're going to really take off because of that.
Yeah.
Being able to take that off and be like, no, I'll be able to overcome it. Like, you haven't been able to overcome it for 5 years.
Yeah.
What makes you think that all of a sudden you're going to be able to do it? You're just not good at it. Get somebody who is.
Well, I think I spent most of my 30s trying to be good at everything, and then that didn't work out so well, because I'm really good at a couple things and I'm really not good at most things.
What are you really good at?
And then I'm really good at people. I'm really good at, I'm incredibly passionate.
Hence the culture.
I'm really good at getting people excited about whatever I'm excited about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really good at reading a room. I can read a room and I know exactly what to do just naturally. I don't have a lot of social anxiety.
That's good.
But then, you know, managing people, oh my gosh. Like, I think in year three, if there was an award for like the worst manager on the planet, I'm pretty sure I would have gotten it. I mean, one of my partners said to me, I should never talk to another staff again. I mean, I was running the company at the time and I was horrified. I'm like, wait, what? And, you know, I just realized that I actually didn't do anything right. I'm not sure I did anything right. Mm-hmm. And you either figure it out or you find somebody else to do it that's better than you. And so for me, unfortunately, I think I spent a lot of time, I guess it is fortunate, because we didn't have money to pay anybody to do it. So I had to figure it out. So I've gotten better. I'd give myself like a 7.5 on managing. I used to be a horrible listener, like horrible.
So was I.
Horrible.
What would you do when other people were talking?
Just keep talking.
You would keep talking.
Heck, well, I mean,
I would do that too. But you know what else I'd do? I'd think about what I was going to say next.
Oh yeah, that too. Mm. I'm from the East Coast. I talk over people. We all talk over each other.
From Chicago. I'm very close.
All right.
Yeah, you guys take it to another level.
We do. We take it to another. We take it to a whole different.
We're on the East Coast.
Yeah, Philadelphia.
Okay. Oh yeah, you guys definitely take it to another
level. And New York, Philadelphia, New York is where I grew up. So yeah. But I think being vulnerable is really important, because, like I said, I could tell horror stories about my experience. Not horror stories, but it's been hard. And I think it's really important that people talk about what's hard. I do a lot of talks, and I talk about, let's talk about the hard stuff. Let's talk about when you're uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about when you're so uncomfortable you want to crawl out of your skin and you don't know what to do. Let's have those conversations, because I think they're really important to have. Because everybody talks about how, oh, my brand's so awesome and the company's awesome and we're doing so great, and it's exhausting.
What about the recent hard spot that you guys just had?
Oh my goodness, it's been over a year, so it's not recent. It's like, it's trying me.
Is it?
Yeah, I'm on my last leg. We're just cresting.
Right, you had to let people go though.
Yeah.
That must have been incredibly hard.
Yeah, like 35.
How'd you deal with that?
I was on a lot of pharmaceuticals. I didn't sleep for a couple months. I had I'm like organic and like, I don't take anything. And the pharmacist knew my name. I thought that was really hilarious, because they were trying to find a cocktail for me to get me to sleep. I didn't sleep. I lost a ton of weight. I couldn't exercise. I couldn't, like, I had anxiety. It was brutal.
Mm-hmm.
On one day last summer, I literally couldn't get up, and I thought I should just get committed. Like, I couldn't get off the floor because I was so just sick to my stomach, because there were decisions that I made, there were calls that I made, risks that I took, the risk averse girl over here that just takes tons of risks, and then all these people. I didn't realize how much responsibility there was in this job, and it really, I think it just really taught me that, look, the decision had to be made. It is what it is. You know, sometimes you can't.
No, or else everybody loses their job, right? The company dies.
The company goes out of business, right? So you either save the business, which is the goal, is to save the business, but to do it in a way that's authentic and taking good care of people, and really in a way that that is humane and, you know, and isn't dollar first. But this was, we got ourselves in a lot of trouble. And we our projections, we were a triple digit growth company for 8 straight years. We were on a rocket ship.
Holy shit.
And we did.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Triple digits for 8 straight years.
I did it for 2. I thought that was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this year we didn't even estimate triple, because you start to get into like tens of millions. You can't triple. So we estimated high doubles and we hit low doubles. So it's not like we didn't grow. We did fine, but we projected so much more.
And you hired for the projection.
And we hired for all of it. Yeah. Mm. We went from 60 to 120 to 78 or something. Yeah.
So I've had a moment like that as well, where I was not getting out of bed, full of anxiety, depressed, and that was actually through my like divorce a year and a half ago. But I ended up coming out a much better person.
Mm.
So I don't know. I'm seeing, like, through that vulnerability you just shared with us, were you able to come out being like, that actually helped my growth? Or are you just like, I'm still dealing with this, but I don't know if there's any
light
at the end of the tunnel just yet?
I don't know about being a better person. I think that all your experiences help you just grow mm-hmm. and be better in general. I think good and bad. I think you need to have them all, because if you just have good experiences all the time, you're not in a reality and you can't relate to other people. I think if you have bad experiences all the time, that's not good either. I think it was huge. I believe that things happen. So how I get through and how I got up that day is I believe that things happen because something bigger is coming down the pike, and you need this information, you need this knowledge mm-hmm. in order to be able to make the decision in the future. So you got to figure this out, because it's going to be that much harder, and you got to know whatever it is that you need to learn. So I learned a ton. I mean, I talked to 30, 40 other CEOs. Michelle and I both did. And I literally had to go from one room to let go of 25 staffers to the other room of 85 people within 30 seconds of each other
mm.
and let go of these people and then tell these people it's going to be okay. But then, like, it literally, like, just tore me apart.
I probably would have vomited in between.
I just basically sat in front of the staff and just cried. I mean, it was, I couldn't even get the words out. It was just heartbreaking. And I think it's made me stronger to what's happening today. Like, there's reality check. Like, you have to run. I think almost maybe you can run it too humanely, right? There has to be you have to be efficient. You have to turn a profit. You have to be able to. So you have to get smarter.
Right.
And I think it helps us get smarter. It helps us, gives us time to fill in cracks. When you're going so fast, the cracks are, you're just doing so well, the cracks, you just kind of throw them by the wayside. So I think it makes everything better. I think it makes the people better. I think it makes the business better. I think it makes you stronger. I think it makes you more real. It
makes you look at projections differently for sure, right?
Well, yeah, now I'm a little bit more conservative. in my last life, I would have said this was the number, but since I can't prove it, this will be the number for now, even though I'm pretty sure the number's that. But mm-hmm. since I can't prove it, let's just go with this number. Yeah.
So so it sounds like after going through something like that, you just from all the things you listed off, you end up learning a ton. So even in the bad, there is good that comes from it. And it would have been way worse to be talking to a room of 125 people.
Yeah, no kidding.
And saying that this is kind of over for all of us because we owe all this money and there's no way to make it meet. And the investors and the bank said no, and I don't know what else to say.
Yeah.
And even then, I would argue that that could be said as a good thing, because then you go into another venture, you do something else in life, and you continue to grow, and you know, you make up for those kind of things, and you learn from that, and it's not like you died. It's not like all those people died. People get so, like, wound to money and to success and to fame that if they lose it all, they think that's the end of life, and some of them actually do it.
Yeah. Well, I think I've learned a really good lesson. I'm not sure I need to go through that, even though I'm sure it would be a great lesson. I'm probably good.
Yeah.
I don't need to go through closing the company.
No, I'm not telling you need to. I'm just saying you could find good in anything.
Oh, of course. I think so. Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
So culture has been big. How was, you guys have built a really good one, and then you have this. So what have you been trying to do to, morale, I will not believe that morale did not take a dip. when that happened.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So
it's brutal.
So what do you do? And I'm sincerely interested because we go through morale dips as well, and we have different like strategies. Some of them work, some of them don't.
Yeah.
I think every company does. It's not like, oh, we're all happy and everything for the whole time. No, that's not, there's like, this happens in morale. Even if you're up here and other companies are like this, even they have this, and it's better you're up here, but these still happen. So while this is happening, what are you guys trying to do to make it go?
Yeah. Well, I don't think we were trying to make it go anywhere. I think what we were doing is having a reality check. And you have meetings and you're super transparent and you say what's going on and you give the why and you call it like it is and you say there's plans in place and we're gonna figure some of this stuff out. And then, you know, so we have monthly town halls. So at every town, we maybe had two that month. And then so at the next town hall, it was like, okay, here's what happened. Here's why. Here's what we had to do. Here's the right thing for the business, to your point of like, there's 80 of us still here, right? And this is a good thing. And then the next meeting was, okay, here's all the things that went wrong. Here's what we're doing to address them. We've got some solutions. We have some that are in process. All you're trying to do is instill confidence. All they want is confidence. Mm-hmm. People just want to believe that you might have made a big miss. Everybody makes mistakes, but what are you going to do about it? That's the most important thing. How are you going to figure it out and how are you going to fix it?
They want leadership, right?
They want leadership. And they don't want, oh my goodness, it was like, I'm an eternal optimist. I mean, it's in everything I do. Mm-hmm. It's just who I am. And so it was like, okay, you got to tone it down, sister, because they would raise their hand and be like, all right, what's up? And they're like, yeah, you got to tone it down. Like this optimism that you see, like endless, I don't feel so optimistic right now. So you had to just really listen. A lot of it was, we spent a couple of days, Michelle and I spent a couple of days just walking. We had no meetings and just walked the plant and just spent time with people and spent time in the lunchroom and just listened and just kind of let it all out because we had been planning for months. Mm-hmm. This just happened in a day. People were freaked out and they had to process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, before long, it was very interesting to watch. People actually were pretty stoked about what resulted. It's a more efficient, it's easier to get through, there's less people to go through. And so while the way it happened, unfortunately, is it wasn't good, the end result actually was really good. And then some of my staff was like, I feel like I'm getting like my master's degree in entrepreneurship, like in building a business. Like I feel like I got the front seat view.
That's how you get it right, is by doing it.
And by doing it, but by being transparent so that everybody can watch and see what happened, mm-hmm. how you messed up, yeah. and then what you're going to do about it, and then watch how you start to fix it.
Do you have an open door policy?
Yeah.
Do people use it?
I don't think so.
They didn't use it with me. I don't even have a door. I mean, I don't even have a freaking wall.
Yeah.
They don't use it. So I started forcing lunches.
You just go out with people?
Lately, it's been every day because I'm trying to get through everyone. I'm like, what do you want from this job?
Yeah.
And it could be, you could talk about money. You could talk about, more time, vacation. I mean, purpose, learning. It's been incredibly beneficial for me. A little easier. I mean, we're a team of like 23. You guys have 80. But I found that when I just started like forcing the open door, I learned a lot.
Yeah.
I love it. So you guys end up learning so much from this, and now it sounds like you're becoming efficient. Have you guys ever looked into lean at all?
Yeah, we have our manufacturing, a lot of it is lean manufacturing.
Okay,
practices.
Cool. Yeah. So now that's basically the choir singing right there. So now that you guys are becoming more efficient, what do you look at in the next couple of years this is what we're looking to do. This is some of the things we're looking to accomplish, and we now have a team that we can totally do it with.
I think driving efficiencies is all we talk about on one side of the business, because that's all ops and finance. And then on the other side, sales and marketing, it's all about sharing home with the world. And we have a product that tastes very different than a lot of the other kombuchas, and you have to kind of get out there and try it. And so our goals for the next couple of years is all marketing. It's all demos and events and digital and focusing, taking all of our focus and focusing on sharing home with the world. And I think that's how we'll grow and keep our number four status. You know, we have a great product. We have an amazing product. We have a patent pending. We're the only kombucha company that is raw, live, compliant, like you name it, patent pending, like it's the real deal.
Mm-hmm.
And we've spent so much time on that, now we have to go out and share it with the world. If I could go back, I was a little operations heavy last handful of years, and I think I could have
It's now time to tell people about it, right?
Yeah, it's time to tell people about it. We're a little behind the eight ball on that.
How far do you guys extend? Like, where you have real market penetration?
Oh, we're everywhere in the country. And then we also have a joint venture in Sweden. So we have a small European plant as well.
Right, but where do you have that? I would imagine you have some of the greatest market penetration in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, yeah. I would say for sure Pacific Northwest by far. Mm-hmm. But we're in like Target and Walmart and Costco and Safeway and Albertsons. And so we're broadline distributed throughout the country. West Coast by far, the whole West Coast.
Okay. A lot of areas of improvement in the Midwest.
Yeah, Midwest we do actually quite well. Midwest loves kombucha.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Then what's an area you guys are trying to snipe then right now?
Probably the southeastern, Midwest, Boston, southeastern, Midwest, California.
And
there's five key markets for us this year.
And what I'm interested in is how you get yourself into Costco and Walmart and Target. I'm sure a lot of people would like to know, yeah, how do you talk to those people?
Yeah. Well, what's really funny about Walmart is, so hum is a disruptor, right? We kind of went this path. Everybody else was in natural and hum went everywhere else.
Yeah.
So what everybody didn't know is when we would go in, all of them said yes to us. They all were like, yeah, we totally want this product.
Because nobody else was pitching it.
Nobody else was pitching it. Yeah. But when we went to Target or Walmart,
but now other people
one.
Are pitching it.
Yeah, so now this is my dilemma for this year. Now everybody's there, and now what do I do? I have to reposition ourselves differently so that we can compete and survive in an environment that's very different than it was a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what we did. We partnered with the NFL. So we became the only kombucha company ever in the history of the United States to partner with the NFL.
How did you partner with the NFL?
Oh my gosh. So one of my board members gave me one phone number, and it was the
one Drew Bledsoe's?
No.
I'm kidding.
It was CenturyLink Stadium, and it was the director of CenturyLink, right? And I called the director of CenturyLink, and this is where I shine. This is stuff I do really well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm able to talk people into whatever. So I got the guy excited enough that he hooked me up with some lady and said, here, talk to this lady. She was like the person that ran the sponsorships or something. And we ended up, she actually liked kombucha, so we ended up sending cases and cases of kombucha to their office. And we got them all hooked on kombucha. And so she's like, all right, well, let me go see if we can sign you. So it takes them 6 weeks to get back to us because, as you can imagine, every non-alcoholic beverage on planet Earth has an agreement with the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it, like energy drinks, water, sure. Everybody's got a contract.
Yeah, Gatorade,
they came back
Coke,
and they went,
yeah.
There's no kombucha contract. We can
Weird.
Sign a contract with you.
Yeah.
And I said, that's awesome. And then they said, it's going to be $250,000. And I was driving at the time, and I was like,
Did you have that capital?
What did you say? And then I was like, hello, and disconnected, right? Because I was driving somewhere, and I totally made this up. I never told her that. One day she'll find out about this. And so because it was more money than I had, my marketing budget was maybe $50,000 or something. When we got off the phone,
Wait a minute. You fake static out of the conversation.
I fake static out of the
oh
conversation.
Oh my God, I've done that for sales calls.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
I was freaking out. On the one hand, I was like, this is the
I love you.
Thing
I do that
ever.
Too. I hit the mute button over and over again. I'm like, what? Sorry. Oh, bye.
Yeah, I don't do it very often. This is
I used to do it all the time when the company was getting going. Anyway, go on. Sorry, I love that you do that.
So she told us the price, and we ended up what we knew was nobody in the NFL, probably like maybe 20 people out of 20 million fans, know what kombucha was. This was 5 years ago, but we knew that we could execute on it in a way, and we would capitalize on it because we would tell a story. And so mm-hmm. when we were in Walmart, the story was. We have a partnership with the NFL, blah, 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 and we were just talking, and they're like, wait, what? The NFL has a kombucha? Oh. And in their brain, they're like, we must need you. Now, they didn't say that, but I'm sure that's what they were thinking.
Oh, that holds a ton of weight.
Holds a ton of weight.
Yeah.
So we just capitalized on it. So we would use that.
The NFL owns a day of the week.
They do.
Yeah. They used to be to churches. Now it's
they
theirs.
They do. Yeah. But we did all sorts of crazy things. Yeah. I think that, We got to run around quite a bit as a small brand, and there were places that we just didn't talk to because they were horrible to work with. And you would find the ones that were really good with small local companies that really wanted to help, and we would.
I got excited and when you did the static thing, and if you did say it, I was laughing too much. But what ended up happening with the $250,000?
Oh, we paid it. We found it.
Okay, you
I
found
it. I think we probably took out a loan or probably like raised some capital for it. Who knows what we did.
It was worth it.
But we had five people in the executive team at the time, and one said absolutely no, one abstained, and three said yes. I was one of the three. Mm-hmm. So it's my call to make, and I was like, all right, well, I'm making the call. We're going to do it. And the cool thing about the people that work at Hum and the executive team is you leave a meeting, even though you go in and you're not in agreement, everybody gets to voice their opinion, everybody gets to have a conversation, but then it is my call to make. And once the call is made, then everybody's on board, and it was full steam ahead. And I'd say, you know, we did it for 3 years, it was good. I would do it again to do what I did, but I wouldn't do it again for my future. Like, there's not enough value in it.
Mm-hmm.
But the Seahawks were amazing. We had a kegerator in the Seahawks
locker room.
No, in their where they ate in their cafeteria.
Okay.
And so they actually had kombucha in their smoothies every day. And we got to meet a lot of them. It was really, really cool. They were all super bought into the kombucha. They I think we still have kegs in there.
Sweet.
Yeah.
So what was the what were some of the main benefits? You mentioned Walmart. I'm fascinated with this NFL deal. So $250,000. You have bragging rights that you can market with.
You're partners with the NFL. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. We had our car and a big booth at the Seahawks. They have a pregame mm-hmm. area. So we sampled out to tens of thousands of people. I think our first game we sold like two bottles of kombucha, which is hilarious. Like $250,000, I got a contract and we sold like $7 worth of kombucha. We knew the ROI wasn't going to be good on this, though. There was a different ROI. It wasn't a pencil ROI. It wasn't a financial.
It was a feeling.
There was more. And here's the thing. So we knew, we were huge. In our brains, we were a huge brand. Like, mm-hmm. we had the world by the balls. But how do you tell the world that you got them? And how do you tell the world that you're huge? One of the ways you can do that is you can partner with the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that partnership all of a sudden says you're huge. So we took that, and we were this tiny little brand. And we took that, and we went to all these big players, and we're like, of course we're huge. We partnered with the NFL. And by the way, we're the first and the only NFL partner. We just played that.
That's exactly how we grew.
Yeah.
Facebook brought us on as their small business and partner members, and I was just like,
yeah,
of course we're great. And people are like, wow, yeah, you must be. And that was
smart. Yeah.
So
you capitalize on
so basically, yeah, I basically. Totally get it. One of my strengths, and I could tell one of your strengths, is sales.
Yeah.
Both of us. So you find that huge thing of credibility, and of course you ride that, and especially for you guys paid $250,000 for it.
Yeah.
But it paid off, so I'm guessing that helped you get Walmart.
I don't know if it helped us get Walmart. I mean, Walmart never said that, but you could use it in a way that made it where I'm sure it helped sway.
Nobody ever says that. I've never had clients say, oh, we're signing with you because Facebook backs you.
No.
They don't say that.
No, but that's, there's, you got cred.
Yeah, that, and a lot of times it allows you to even come to the table.
Yeah.
It allows a meeting to happen. Right? Those are hard enough to do. Okay, so NFL was before Walmart.
Yeah, it was before.
Okay. What else was it before? Was it before Target? And
I think we were in Target before the NFL.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
Costco.
And that was, I don't know.
So
probably after.
What I love in the story is just like your go-getter attitude, this whole thing of just like making a call, because a lot of people, even with the brand position that you would have, be like, oh, we can't deal with the NFL, they're too big, it's too intimidating.
Yeah.
But I don't think you thought that for a second.
No, well, when we signed we got on the phone and she goes, okay, let's do it. And I'm like, great, what should we do? And she goes, I don't know anything about kombucha. And I'm like, I don't know anything about football. I mean, seriously, it was ridiculous. Like, I don't even know any of the players' names. It was awful. But I, so we had to kind of figure it out and work through it together, which was really
hilarious.
So
what did you guys do? I heard you being the Seahawks sponsor on the radio once.
Oh, yeah. We did all sorts
the
of things.
The official kombucha of the Seattle Seahawks. I heard that.
Yeah, but then Eric was Michelle's former husband who came on to help with all of the culture stuff.
He
was the driver. Well, all the boys there know football.
Yeah, you're welcome. That's right.
But he was the driver. He was the executor. So he was really there making it happen and getting it all done. And we got a lot of leverage out of that. It was great. And it was great all around, but we wouldn't have signed if the Seahawks weren't drinking the product. So if it wasn't in their tap room, so there's authenticity there, right? You mm-hmm. can't have a partner that is just a partner for show. There has to be an energetic authenticity for us to do any kind of partnership. So a couple days before we signed, it wasn't in the cafeteria. And I was like, I was relentless. I was like, it's got to be in the cafeteria. Well, I can't promise. Well, then I don't know what to tell you, but it's got to be in that. And so that was a huge piece of it. So nobody saw that, but that doesn't matter. It's the energetic piece and knowing
that's the
that
culture piece you're talking about.
And then I'll tell you a really funny story. So the Seahawks were having a shitty year. Uh-huh. They were like 0-4.
And then they drank kombucha.
I'm telling you what, you can't make this shit up. They started drinking the kombucha. And their season completely turned around. You can look this up. One of the things I will tell you about is I'm an exaggerator and an embellisher, but I am not exaggerating or embellishing on this. This is a true story.
Okay.
And it's hilarious because it's true and you can't make it up.
Gatorade won't like this story. Yeah. Go on.
No, there's nothing more to say. That's it.
They went 0-4 and then what?
I don't know. Whatever. They did really well and they probably went to the playoffs. I'm not sure what happened then. It's irrelevant.
Wait, so they were 0-4 and then they drank it and then they
actually
won the Super Bowl?
No, they didn't win the Super Bowl that year, but they had a solid year.
They did probably a year after really, that. I mean, that's amazing. Okay.
And it's really true. And I was actually at a speech in New York City and I dropped that and I'm like, you guys, and they're all laughing and they're like, yeah, right. I'm like, I'm telling you, I'm a bullshitter, but I am not bullshitting on this. This is the real deal.
So what's over the good tips you've given so far, what's your number one tip on running a successful business?
Know your why. Get really, really clear Simon about Sinek. Why you're doing what you're doing. Well, I never didn't know about Simon Sinek when I was trying to figure out my why. It had nothing to do with him. But, I mean, yes, that's very smart.
Right, right. But somebody can go and watch that video.
But the reason is because you're going to get knocked down a ton and you're going to hit a bunch of obstacles. And if you don't know, or if you're not really bought into why you're doing it, mm-hmm. It's going to be really hard to make it. And I think coupled with that is passion. You have to really be bought. You have to be so passionate about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. I think those two hand in hand is a really sweet starter for anything.
I would agree. Having that passion, especially in those like sales rooms, like when people see that and they're like, wow, you know, he or she really believes in what they're talking about. That makes me worry. If you're just trying to do something to, you know, make ends meet and to get maybe buy a yacht or whatever the case is, right? But it's not like the overall purpose for it. People start to see right through that.
Yeah. Well, it's the stuff people don't see. You're passionate about it. You live and breathe it. Like, mm-hmm. they don't need to see that I was eating peanut butter and jelly for 2 years. That's irrelevant. But for me, it was worth that because my kids were bought into it. My kids didn't have furniture, and they knew why. And they were like, Mom, this is so important. You got to do this. You know, so people don't see that, but that's you need that drive and that passion in order to get yourself through. It's mm-hmm. not just for the outside world.
So what's it like now with this competitive market? Like, I've just noticed you have all these people are basically jumping on and following in your footsteps. Mm-hmm. So how do you change? How do you differentiate again?
Well, I don't know if you change. I think you maybe...
Become more efficient?
Yeah, I mean, you make sure you're doing what you set out to do, which is make kombucha available to the masses, make an accessible product. Our goal is to make a premium product at an affordable price. That's mm-hmm. we want to make the best quality product at the most affordable price that you can, so that more people can drink it. I think, you know, it's bringing more experts to the table. My goal is, like, in my 40s, this is what happened. In my 30s, I tried to be great at everything. In my 40s, I surrounded myself with people that were great at all the things I wasn't good at. So I surrounded myself with experts in all the fields that I wasn't good at, which was a lot of people. Because like I said, I'm good at a couple of things. There's a lot of things I'm not good at. And you need to be good at a lot of things in a business. A business needs a lot of good things to happen. So I think now that the industry has changed a bit and the competition has changed, you have to reevaluate and you have to figure out how you're going to compete in this new environment. And, you know, different experts, you know, our private equity partners are really, really good at CPG. And so bringing them on board to really get guidance, new board mm-hmm. members, whatever it might be, keep seeking guidance from people that have done it before, because this isn't rocket science. And also what's happening in this category has happened in many categories. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of find people that have been through it before. And
so you're pro mentorship then?
That's what it's all about.
Yeah. I agree. How do you go about getting them?
Well, I think there's a really interesting trick to getting people to help you when you're small and you have no money and you have nothing to give back. There's a super interesting trick.
Please.
Okay. So you're small and you're an entrepreneur. You have nothing to give back. You have no money. You have no expertise. You have no nothing. And here you have the super smart person who's been doing it for 20 years, mm-hmm. who has a lot of money or whatever they have. They have something you need.
Which, by the way, for those listening in Bend, there's a ton of them in Bend.
There's a ton of them in Bend. And there's a lot of people that want to help. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just have to ask. You just have to ask. And if you don't get answers, keep asking different people.
So is that the trick?
No,
the trick?
That's not the trick at
all. Okay,
what's
the trick?
Here's the trick. So everybody wants to feel valued. And yes. everybody wants to, no matter how much money you have or how much anything or how successful you are, you want to feel valued. And one of the things about growing a business and being an entrepreneur is you get to a part where you're more mature and it's not as exciting and it's not as, but a young entrepreneur that is starting from scratch, it is very exciting. And for an entrepreneur, it's pretty cool. Like you're reading spreadsheets these days and it's, you know, 200 people, but when it was really fun when you were small. So one of the things you can do is when somebody helps you and you have a meeting and they give you a bunch of advice and you know, you use 2% of it, whatever you would use, right? And then you ask for another meeting. And when you come back to the meeting, the first thing you do is you go, here's what I heard last time. Here's what I did. Here's how it helped me. Here's how it made a difference. Here's what I didn't use. You can say that or not. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And then here's where I'm struggling today. What do you think about this? What you've just done is you've given somebody a sense of purpose. You've given them, like, now they feel validated. Mm-hmm. Now they feel like they're worthy, that their time has been valued. While you're seeing a difference, you're actually helping someone, and they start wanting to help you. It is one of my gifts to be able to surround myself with a lot of people that are interested in what it is I'm doing. And I think a lot of it has to do with giving back in a way that there's no dollar amount. See, it's all about feeling good, right? It's all about taking good care of each
Absolutely.
Other. And you can take good care of anyone that has way more than you in every way, shape, and form. Mm-hmm. Because human is human. And you've got gifts that that person doesn't have.
Yeah, you know, the way I like to put that one, because I have a bunch of mentors that help me tremendously, and I'm in debt to them big time, and I don't pay them anything. They get back to me because I basically do what you do. But there's people that are starting out that are kind of intimidated by asking and stuff like that, and the way you put it is really, really good for breaking through to somebody being like, this person wants to feel valued. And a lot of times, a lot of entrepreneurs that are really successful sometimes don't feel that valued. They could go around being like, God, you know, my wife really doesn't care. My husband doesn't really care that I'm the owner or CEO. Employees don't really care. My friends don't really care. I don't like talking about it anyway because then we're talking about money and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, here comes this person who really cares and like wants your help. And it just kind of invigorates them. Mm-hmm. And when people come asking, like, not that I have a lot, I mean, I've built a fraction of what you have, but I know a few things from building this up from bootstrap like you have, and I love it. I'm like, wow, yeah, you really do care, and I'm like, yeah, I'll help you here. I've even helped competitors mm-hmm. out in, like, Michigan and stuff. I'm like, this is what you need to do. I've helped a team member here who left to start his own digital marketing agency, and I was just like, all right, this is what you want to do. Mm-hmm. But there actually was a time talking about vulnerabilities when I would do the opposite when we're first starting out, and I'd be like, I'm gonna sue you, and I never ended up doing it, but
mine
would go in a very bad way.
Yeah.
So I'm happy I grew out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's awesome that you look for that, and not only that, but it seems that as you've been talking that you still surround yourself with mentors, so you haven't grown out of it.
I surround myself with people that are way smarter than me in every facet of things I don't know anything about. I'm surrounded by a bunch of brilliant experts, and I'm usually the dumbest person in the room.
And by you just saying that you're saying that you're okay with that.
Oh, heck yeah.
A lot of people aren't.
But here's the thing.
A lot of people purposely don't do that.
Well, that's an ego thing. That's a dude thing.
Of course it is.
Yeah, that's a guy thing. Girls, I don't know if we have much. I mean, generally speaking, I don't know that, like I said, we have a lot of issues, like mood swings and all these things that you have to account for, but that I don't really
Ego
care. Because
really
the thing,
at the
end of the day, I'm probably smarter than everybody, because what I can do is I can take all the information, and I'm really, really good at filtering it and figuring out what to do from the information. But I don't come up with information on my own. I need all the experts in the room to mm-hmm. give me their opinion, and then I'm able to come up with a really good solution for the company, and that's my gift. So I'm going to take my gifts and I'm going to capitalize on it, and all the things I'm not good at, I'm going to find people that are really good at.
Do you get around with multiple mentors at one time for like lunch and dinner stuff, or is it more of a one-to-one type thing?
I don't think I've ever done multiple, even though we have a board, and I would consider all the board mentors and guides. Mm-hmm. So when we have board meetings and board dinners, we all get together, but I don't think I do it together. I don't
either. I was just curious.
Yeah, every so often.
Do you have a book that you gift a lot?
I have a couple books I gift. So The E-Myth is one of them. So that was the book that got us started. So that's the book that kind of takes you from, you have this idea.
I've been told to read that so many times.
Oh my gosh, it's so good. It was the way we understood how you had an idea and you had a small business, but how you grew it. So how you went from you doing all the jobs to having 30 jobs and having one job filled by somebody, and one job filled by somebody is actually one person could fill seven jobs, you know, whatever it was. So it really, it helped us to scale and understand, and that was the most tangible book. And then there was another book called Entrepreneurial DNA, which is written by Joe Abraham. And this was about when we were going from Kombucha Mama to Hum, and we knew we were gonna be huge and national, and we also knew we were missing a lot of things to get there. Like, we didn't have, Michelle didn't have all the skills, and we were able to read this book and understand what we had and what we were looking for so that we could get some help from people and hire people that had skills that we didn't have. So that was huge. And then, you know, Start With Why. I mean, that's a huge one.
E-Myth, though, so a lot. You said it is the most tangible. So do you have like a beat up copy?
And I have a bunch of beat up copies that I loan out as well, but I have my own probably personal beat up copy somewhere.
Yeah. I'll have to, you're probably the fifth person to tell me. I'm a big reader. I've been recently going into philosophy a bit more, but I'm going to start sprinkling some more business books, so I'll tackle that one. Coming from you and a few other people, it's time, so I'll tackle that. If you had a billboard for the world to see that didn't talk about Hum, what would it say?
It didn't talk about Hum?
No. Or another venture you're trying to start.
Nah. It would say, because Hum is just a catalyst. It would say, follow your heart.
Follow your heart.
Follow your heart. So I think way back when I started this, I had a very successful business, and I was a breadwinner, and I had a couple kids, and I had a husband.
Right, I didn't ask it at all. So like 15 years you had it, right? Successful,
yeah.
What was it?
And I had a bunch of them too, but this one was very, very financially successful. I was a recruiter, and I had, I was an IT recruiter, and I had consultants all over the country. And my family was freaking out. Actually, most people I knew, they're like, kombucha, what? And literally, the world is very, very loud, and they're very talkative, and your friends, your family, they all know better, or they all have had an experience that they have to share with you, and
isn't
you should really
great?
Take this into account. And the thing is, you gotta just like tone, like, you gotta know that, you gotta put your earmuffs on, and really, if you follow what's in here, because let me tell you, I had more money, I had the house, I had the kid, I had everything. Everything. I even had the community, I had the friends, I had it all. The grass was always greener for me. There was something missing. And when I followed my heart and had nothing for a lot of years, I was never happier. I divorced my husband during that time, I was never happier. And I'm not saying that was, we're really good friends today.
And
like, it was actually a very amicable divorce.
Good friends there too.
But divorcing is, it is what it is. You can have the easiest divorce in the world and it's horrible. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying at all that that was easy, but I was never happier. Like, that was the right call for me. It was just the right thing to do. And when you follow what's in here, even though it doesn't make sense to the rest of the world, it really takes you at a whole new level. And then you can take that and share that with the world, and people can watch that, and they watch you take really big chances and do things that don't seem like the norm and come out okay. And then it allows them to take risks and allows them to be a little bit more vulnerable and think outside the box. And I think the more people that do that, we're a happier world.
Perhaps follow your heart and make sure you validate it on the way.
You don't have to validate anything.
Well, no, I was making a reference to the beginning days of having the kombucha milk person service.
Oh, but there was no validation. We had no idea what we were doing. People just kept saying yes. And if they didn't say yes, I'm sure that I talked a bunch of them into it. Like,
knowing you, telling me what,
so,
you have to drink this.
You have to drink this. And if people said no, it's just hilarious. Some people around town, it became this rumor that she just doesn't hear no.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that. I think that I'm just probably not explaining it in a way that you can hear if you're saying no, because I'm so sure that this is going to make you feel better. And my goal is to help you feel better. And I just, if you're saying no, it means I'm just saying it in a way you can't hear, and I'll just keep crafting it in different ways until, you know, you say yes, or you just want me to stop talking and you'll just take it just to make it go away.
So last question, if you had, if you took your mind right now and dropped it into your 18-year-old body, and you're thinking the way you are right now, but you're 18, what do you think you'd do?
Well, I would tell my 18-year-old self that I really don't know it all, and to listen and watch And I think that's like the biggest for me is that I went through my 20s knowing everything and mm-hmm. couldn't take help from anyone. I think I missed out a lot of...
Sounds like my 20s.
Yeah, a lot of growth.
So I like how you ended up validating that twice. You were talking about that earlier, about listening, and that was something that you were not good at to go back
to. You want to hear my story on listening? So yeah. Every year I work on something. I got a couple things I'm working on, maybe a relationship or kids or whatever. So I don't know if it's going to be personal or professional, but usually it's a mix of that. And listening, I did listening for a year. And then after that first year, I was like, wow, I've got some work to do. So I did listening again for another year. And then after the second year, I was like, still don't quite got this one. So it was 3 years of focusing on listening every year, every day. Every time somebody talked, all sorts of things I was trying to do to make it so that I could listen. It is just not in my nature at all. It took me 3 years of focusing on something so that I could actually wear. I'm told I'm a good listener these days. Nope.
Okay. Did you read any books or anything?
I'm self-taught for
everything. YouTube videos on how to listen? Or just like listening is pretty self-intuitive. You listen.
I probably had people telling me I need to listen more and giving me guidance. I'm not really sure. I'm sure Eric and Michelle, they're always good listeners, my partner. I'm sure that they helped me along the way, but nothing formal. And it took me forever. I was just, my gosh, that was just not in my nature. It was just not my natural ability. It was brutal. And today people would say, a lot of people say I'm a good listener. I think it's one of those things I'm gonna work on forever because it's just not a natural thing for me. Mm-hmm. I think I've gotten a ton better. But you know, being able to sit still and just listen and not have an agenda like you're talking about while people are talking or not talking over someone because you're sure that what is going on for you is right. Listening's a funny one. But I think it's I think it makes the difference. I talk about being a good leader and a good person and a good example of how we should all do it. That's a big one.
I keep on feeling like I'm listening to somebody else describe my life when you're talking.
We should hang out more.
Yeah, I guess so. So what are you working on this year?
Personally?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Okay, so I'm shiny object girl. And not only am I shiny object, but I've actually tempered that quite a bit. But I just... I'm working on this because two of my business partners have really asked me. So I basically do this. I go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And I'm on path for a moment, and then I veer, and then I veer, and then I veer. And it's very, what I've been told is it's very hard to follow that. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to buy in and follow that. And just I'm working on staying on a straight line, and honestly, I have no idea how to do it. I don't even begin to know.
I don't know how to do that either.
Yeah, but I'm really working on it because it's very hard on people around me, mm-hmm. and it causes a lot of mixed messages, and it's not okay. But I haven't. I probably need to ask a few questions to some people that are smarter and better than me.
God, I have the same problem. My team's all the time like, but another crazy idea, another direction and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I've actually been telling myself it's okay. I don't think it is after talking to you.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's okay for you, and it's okay for a lot of things, but for the people around you, it's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have to keep on changing, like, what we're doing and how we're doing it. Well, I think we can end up talking for hours, but I'll conclude it. I think this has been incredibly insightful and will end up helping a lot of people in business currently or want to go into business. And Jamie, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Sweet.
I appreciate
it. Yeah, my pleasure.